Good morning. It's good to see everyone this morning. Can you hear me, Wes? Am I on? I know it may have been a little more difficult to get out of bed this morning. A little darker outside, maybe, than usual. You woke up. It's good to have everyone here present. I hate daylight savings time. But we live in a time-conscious society, don't we? We live in a society that lives and dies by the clock, don't we? It's not the case in every society. In college, I spent 6 weeks in Kenya. Watches are for decorations there. When you say 1 o'clock, you just mean the afternoon. When you say 8 o'clock, you just mean the morning. I have a very, very different view of time. In fact, most cultures before our industrialized society had a very different view of time. Jesus' culture had a very different view of time. Time was not as important. The hours, the minutes were not as important. Which makes it important when we read along in the New Testament in the story of Jesus, and we are told specifically about a certain time, which is what we get in our text this morning. Mark tells us at the beginning of chapter 14 and in verses 12 through 13 again, he gives us a definite time marker. He says, "Now, it was the time of Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread." A very important time in the Jewish calendar. The Passover, the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, was a time when Jews all over Israel ascended to the city of Jerusalem in droves. Jerusalem typically had a population of that time, probably around 50,000, and it could get as much as 300,000 to 350,000 during the festival. It was a time when families got together and they celebrated the event that made Israel, Israel. The event way back in the past when Israel was enslaved. Israel was a no-named, no-God people in the land of Egypt under the thumb of Pharaoh. But God, their God, remembered their slavery, heard their groaning, heard their cry, and came and delivered them. Came with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm and brought them out from the cruel dominion of Pharaoh into his service. And if you don't know the story, there were 10 mighty deeds, 10 wonders, 10 plagues. And that last fateful plague was the plague of the firstborn, where God had all the Israelites kill a firstborn lamb and take the blood of the lamb and paint it over their doorpost and lintels, because God said, "My angel is going to visit the land of Egypt, and he will claim the firstborn of every family. But if he sees the blood on the lintel and the doorpost, the angel will pass over, and your firstborn will be spared." The Passover. That was the festival that Israel celebrated. It was a festival of their freedom, of that terrible, awful freedom. Remembering when they were not free, remembering when they were enslaved, but that God had called them and worked wonders in their midst. The Freedom Festival. And Jesus picks this festival to go to Jerusalem and to die. Jesus had a choice about when he was going to die. Jesus knew that if he went to Jerusalem and did the things that we have talked about him doing in Jerusalem, that he would die. He had been telling his disciples the whole time, "I'm going to Jerusalem. I will be handed over. I will be betrayed and they will kill me." But it is important. It is important for us because it was important for Jesus that he picked the Passover festival. He picked this time to go to Jerusalem to die. And it tells us something about what Jesus understood that he was doing in his death. That this was a death that was meant to be reflected on, thought about, received with the aura of Passover in the background. The liberation festival. So Jesus goes to Jerusalem during this Passover festival. And our text picks up on Wednesday night. Jesus will be betrayed Thursday night, and on Friday night will be crucified. But the story that we just read happens Wednesday night. And he's at the home of Simon the leper, the rabbi with his 12 disciples, eating a meal, a private meal. And I imagine Jesus is quite somber, perhaps. The disciples, they don't know what's about to happen. But there they are in a private meeting room eating. And there at the doorway stands a woman. And she casts her glance over the mealtime participants. They would have been reclining. They didn't sit in chairs, would have been reclining at a table no more than a foot off the ground. And then she finds them. She sees him, Jesus. And in the middle of this meal, with all the chatter, with all the chuckles perhaps, she goes and she kneels down behind Jesus as he reclines and takes out an alabaster jar full of nard. Nard, a perfume that is found, was made in India. Terribly expensive. And she breaks that expensive jar and lets the perfume caress and fall down the head of Jesus, drip onto his clothes. I imagine that the meal stopped. I have to say, as I've thought about this story this week, I am so impressed by the courage of this woman. Women didn't break into a meal where men were sitting. That wasn't social convention. Women didn't belong. But this woman, she breaks in and breaks social convention and risks so much to go and kneel behind Jesus and give him this extravagant gift. I don't know much about this woman. Mark doesn't tell us much about this woman. We don't even know her name. But I imagine that this jar of ointment was pretty special, maybe even a family heirloom. We learn later that it's worth a whole year's worth of wages. In our money, just take the minimum wage, $16,000 spent, expended on the head of Jesus. Wow. Wow. She takes probably the thing that is most precious to her. And she comes in and puts it all on the line to anoint the head of Jesus. You have to admire her bravery. It's extraordinary that her deviant presence there is accepted, but Jesus has been accepting women all throughout his ministry. Rodney Stark is a historian of early Christianity, And he looks at the growth, the amazing, the exponential growth of Christians in the first several centuries. The Christian faith exploded across the Roman world. And he asks, what are the reasons for this explosive growth? And one of the reasons, one of the main reasons, Stark says, is because Christianity was so affirming, so open to women. That in a pagan world that saw women at best as second-class citizens, women in droves came to Christianity because that faith spoke with dignity and respect and gave women status and honor that they did not have anywhere else. Why? I suspect because this is what Jesus did. This is who Jesus was. This nameless woman. Giving this nameless woman dignity, status, that she could do. She was pulled to that room with her most precious object to break it and spill it over the head of Jesus. She's audacious. But I have to say, I understand the disciples. I mean, they're practical. They're sensible. They look at this and you can hear the slow murmur as they're whispering, as they're watching this. Do you see how much nard that is? Do you see how much ointment that is? That's got to be like a whole year's worth of wages. And that murmuring escalates until you can hear it, until she can hear it, that should have been sold and given to the poor. I'm with the disciples here. I can identify with them. What a waste. What could that money have done? How many mouths could that money have fed? How many clothes could that money have bought? Yeah, I don't identify with the woman. I identify with the disciples, and that's a little troubling to me. But one thing Jesus says in reply, he quotes a verse from the book of Deuteronomy. It doesn't look like he quotes it because rabbis at that time knew the Pentateuch back and forward, and they could quote things. And when they quoted things, what they had in mind was the larger context of Scripture. And he quotes from Deuteronomy 15. You have it there. Listen, if anyone is poor among your fellow Israelites in any of the towns of the land that the Lord your God is giving you, don't be hard-hearted or tight-fisted toward them. Rather, be open-handed and freely lend whatever they need. Give generously to them and do so without a grudging heart. Then because of this, the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in everything you put your hand to. This is the part Jesus quotes. There will always be poor people in the land. Therefore, I command you, be open-handed toward your fellow Israelites who are poor and needy in your land. See, what Jesus is saying is He's reminding them, yes, there will always be poor people in the land. And it's not Jesus being resigned to people in poverty. It's not Jesus saying, hey, don't worry about people in poverty. No, He's quoting Deuteronomy 15 to remind them they will always have opportunity to serve. And in fact, God commands them to serve those who are poor. But there's something else going on at this moment that they fail to see, but that this woman gets. Leave her alone, Jesus says. Leave her alone. Because what she's done is a beautiful thing. And I find myself asking, what compels a woman to risk, to break social convention and give, pour out so much nard on the head of Jesus? What explains this? It's an act of worship that seems so out of place. And in fact, the only thing that can explain it is the profound experience of love. Love that is not practical. Love that is not sensible. Love that is rather extravagant. Love that is absurd. Love that is crazy. Crazy love. Nothing justifies the pouring out of this oil except love alone. Oswald Chambers in My Utmost for the Highest says, "If human love does not carry a man beyond himself, it is not love. If love is always discreet, always wise, always sensible and calculating, never carried beyond itself, it's not love at all. It may be affection. It may be warmth of feeling. But it has not the nature of true love in it." I can understand crazy love. I can understand it because my wife's here. And I did some absurd, crazy things in order to show her, to illustrate for her, my love. But love does that. Love makes you do absurd things. I was talking to someone in our Stepping Stones program this week. She was sharing how her daughter, who didn't want to go to college, didn't want to go away, was very much a homebody. Well, where is she this spring break? Well, she's down in Florida. Why is she down there? Because her boyfriend is there. Said, "I never would have thought she would have gone, but the things that we do, the things that we do for love." And that's what this woman is doing. Love doesn't have a calculus. Love doesn't work off the same calculating, counting that the disciples are doing. This past week, a church member told me that sometimes she just wants to burst out singing here in the assembly, but she doesn't. Her heart is so full, she wants to just sing out, but she doesn't because she knows it would be awkward and odd. That's adoration. That's love. It makes us do awkward, odd things. It can't be computed. It can't be calculated. It works on a different logic, the logic of love. Ironically, it's someone who knows what it means to serve the poor that helps me most understand this woman. If I were to ask you what 20th century figure most epitomizes service of the poor, and if I were to go around the room, we would probably throw out several names, but I bet we could all agree on one name. One person who served the poor probably better than anyone else. Mother Teresa. We know something of her story. We know of her reputation. Someone who spent her life, expended her life in the slums of India, serving those poorest of the poor. But here's what Mother Teresa says. Listen. "I make a holy hour each day in the presence of Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament." She's talking about communion. "All my sisters of the Missionaries of Charity make a daily holy hour as well, because we find that through our daily holy hour, our love for Jesus becomes more intimate, our love for each other more understanding, and our love for the poor more compassionate. In 1963, we were making a weekly holy hour together. But it was not until 1973 when we began our daily holy hour that our community started to grow and blossom." You hear what she says? This woman who gave her life over to serving the poor. She says, the success we had, the faithfulness we had, couldn't have come without surrendering ourselves in adoration for an hour each day. And so every time Mother Teresa had another convent built where her missionaries of charity sisters would go and serve the poor, she would not build a chapel, she would not build a convent unless it also had a chapel where the sisters would meet an hour every day to love, to adore, to worship. And that event, that time, was what gave them their orientation, their grounding to help love their neighbor. Marva Don has written a book entitled Worship is a Royal Waste of Time. Pretty provocative title. Worship, a royal waste of time. What she means by that, it's royal. It's about God and it's about His kingdom. It's about getting ourselves off of center, getting the focus off ourselves and adoring God for what God has done, for what God is doing, for God, for what God will do. It's not about us. But it's also a waste. In other words, it doesn't make sense in earthly terms. It doesn't make sense when we show up and give ourselves in adoration, give ourselves in worship. That doesn't make sense. It works on a different register, a different calculus. It's not about ourselves. It's not about producing anything. It's not about our productivity, but it's about bringing ourselves and receiving, offering ourselves. Not what we achieve, but what we receive. And it's a royal waste of time because time is not important here. The clock cannot, must not determine our worship when we immerse ourselves in the eternal God of splendor. Love that is beholden to the clock is love that loves very little. Jesus says, she's done a beautiful thing to me. And the story ends with something that Jesus says about no other event in His ministry. Wherever the gospel is preached, this story will be told. See, Jesus knows that His story will be told, that what He has done and what He will do at Calvary and at the resurrection will be preached. The gospel will go forth. But it's as if He's reminding His disciples here, you're going to preach this good news. But remember, when you preach this story, preach this nameless woman. Because something so central, so important is here in this woman's action. And I think it's adoration. It's this woman who pours all she has on the head of Jesus because she knows that Jesus is pouring Himself out for her. It's a beautiful thing that she has done for me. Wouldn't you like for Jesus to say that about you? Wouldn't you like for Jesus to say that about Highland Hills? It's a beautiful thing that they have done for me. It's a beautiful thing that she, that He, has done for me. I find myself wanting Jesus to say this about me. And so I'm drawn to this woman. The way this woman shows me, the way of worship, the way of beauty, the way of goodness. That's, she shows me it's not about my beauty. It's not about my goodness. But it's about the one who gives beauty and goodness to all there is because he says he gives himself to us. This woman shows me a way of worship that frees me from my pretension, that brings me out of the bondage of my self-centeredness, that frees me from the shackles of my faithful calculating, my idolatry, and frees me to respond in love, to respond in worship, to respond in adoration, to respond to the majesty of Jesus, to pour myself out for Him as He has poured Himself out for me. To follow this woman in the good, beautiful work of worship. And in my mind's eye, as I think about this scene, and I'm sitting there with the disciples, and I see this woman behind Jesus, I see her lips moving. And I can hear something. And I strain to hear. And I hear her soft singing as she runs her hands over the oil, over the head of my Savior. And she's saying, Majesty, worship His Majesty. Unto Jesus be all glory, power, and praise. And I want to sing with her. Let's sing with her, church.